The How Not to Suck at Divorce podcast cannot be copied or rebroadcast without consent. This podcast does not contain legal advice. The information provided on the podcast and the resources available are not intended as and shall not be construed or understood to be legal advice.
Okay, buckle up, because full disclosure, both of my kids are still awake and they are in the room right next to me watching YouTube, and I've already legitimately yelled at them twice, threatening to take away the TV, which we both know I'm not going to do.
Yeah, who does that?
Right, but then what am I going to do with them?
You want the lawyers to be as invested in problem solving as the clients are.
And this is How Not to Suck at Divorce. And I can hear their little voices right now, and it's making me crazy.
Hey, at least they're not behind you. Remember that one night when I looked up and your son was behind you and scared you to death?
Yeah, it was like the call is coming from inside the house.
Totally. Well, speaking of which, I am obsessed with two things this week, and they're quick ones.
I love this segment because it brings about things that we didn't even know we needed.
Things that we're literally obsessed with.
Going into the kid thing. So two nights ago, I was in the hospital all night with my little guy. And yeah, he's fine. He just had a really bad allergic reaction. And so one of the things I'm obsessed with is really nice medical professionals. There's nothing that makes a parent feel more out of control than being in a situation with a child and a medical issue. And when there's nice, caring people, which honestly, I found there's a lot of them in the medical profession, I just want to give a shout out to them because, man, you guys made us feel okay and we got it under control and we were actually able to go home about 3:30 in the morning. So my next day at work was really awesome.
Rough.
I know, it's rough, but you know, you move on. And then the other thing that's pretty obsess worthy is we always joke that nobody ever DMs me. Everyone always wants to talk to Andrea. No one wants to talk to me unless it's for an attorney referral, which is wonderful, which I got a few of those this week. But I actually had someone stop me in the courthouse and ask if I was Morgan from How Not to Suck at Divorce. Well, and I know. And this person was adorable. Mary, shout out to you. You're so cute, so sweet. And I loved meeting you. And just being face-to-face with somebody who actually listens is pretty awesome. So I'm obsessed with that this week.
Aw, I'm obsessed with Mary too. I'm obsessed with Mary. Proud Mary.
Proud Mary.
Rolling right in to the meat of our show today. Collaborative law, a collaborative divorce, a phrase that, I mean, obviously you're more familiar with it than I am, I would hope, but I hear it all the time. And especially like early on when I was getting divorced, I'm like, what the hell are these people talking about? So I'm looking forward to having this conversation with attorney Chris from Austin. And let's see what she has to say. Let's learn a little and let's see, Morgan, you get to put your legal hat on.
I can't wait. I'm actually really excited about her because we knew we wanted to do a collaborative episode, and I went to the experts that I know in Chicago on collaborative law, and I asked them for the best person that they know, you know, nationwide, who's really like a leader in the space. Mm-hmm. And that's how we got to Chris to talk about that tonight. So Chris is out of Austin, Texas, a family law attorney there. We'll let her talk a little bit about her background, but I can't wait to dive into this and see if this is a good process for our listeners.
Okie dokie, guys. Time to learn a little something. Let's do this. Okay, so collaborative is a term that's used a lot these days in divorce chat. And Morgan and I both felt that it was important to dedicate an entire episode to really explaining the difference between a collaborative divorce and a more typical divorce process.
That's exactly right. And we think it's important to understand these differences when you're deciding which route you may go. AKA, we are collaborating tonight with Austin area attorney Chris Algert, who practices a lot of collaborative divorce cases. In fact, she's kind of impressive, everybody. I told you why I was excited to have her on. One of the reasons is because she came from a highly referred source. But also, if you look at her background, she served as a board member and president of the statewide organization for collaborative divorce in Texas. And she even does trainings for lawyers, mental health professionals, and financial professionals in collaborative law. So if you want somebody that's the real deal in collaborative law, we are talking to her. Chris, thank you so much for being here with us, and welcome to How Not to Suck at Divorce.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the introduction, and I really appreciate you all giving me an opportunity to talk a little bit about collaborative divorce so your listeners will understand that they have options.
And that's really what I think is one of the main reasons why we wanted to have this conversation, because, okay, so I'm in a lot of Facebook groups that have to do with divorce. And I talk about this a lot, obviously, on like different social media platforms and in my real day-to-day life. And when you're in these groups and you're talking to all these people, you hear a lot of different terms that are thrown around pretty loosely. And one of the buzzy terms right now is collaborative divorce. And honestly, I never understood what it meant. I kind of thought that it meant that the divorcing couple was just getting along during the process and they're collaborating on things. And I, hearing that, I was always feeling like a little bit envious, thinking, oh, I wish I could collaborate. So, Chris, let's start here. By definition, what is a collaborative divorce?
Yeah, a collaborative divorce, the simplest definition is, it is a dispute resolution process where the parties and their lawyers commit upfront that they are not going to go to court to resolve any differences, that they will produce all information on a voluntary, informal basis, and they will use what's called interest-based negotiation to try to address what is most important to each of the spouses.
Huh. Okay.
Interesting. All right, let me weigh in here legally. Yeah. I think I know the answer to this, and I want to circle back. I have two questions for you, but answer this for our listeners. Are all attorneys able to practice in the collaborative space?
So, you know, technically, any lawyer anywhere in the world can choose to offer collaborative divorce services. In the ideal world, the lawyers who are offering collaborative divorce have been trained in the collaborative process, because it's a really different way for the lawyers to think about how they're approaching and advising the client and handling the divorce. So ideally, you want trained collaborative lawyers. But technically, any lawyer out there could decide they want to be a collaborative divorce lawyer.
Okay, that makes sense. And that was what I believed would be the answer. What I want to ask you is, you went through a few ways of or ideas of people committing to the process. What was that third way? I understand informally handing over documents, which is, you know, what most of us call discovery, and you're doing it in an informal process. I understand committing as a group to, you know, stay out of court. You said something, the third prong. What was that?
Yeah, that is the use of interest-based negotiation. And, you know, what that means is you actually have to spend a little time up front trying to understand what is most important to the spouses, what are their primary goals, what are their primary concerns. And there is a book called Getting to Yes, written by Fisher and Urey of Harvard Law School. And they say, when you know what's important to people, what their interests are, then you can look for solutions that meet both parties' interests.
Yep.
So it is a form of negotiating that doesn't involve strong-arming the other side to do what you want, or kind of just the bargaining where everybody's heading towards the middle and looking for a compromise. It really is trying to look for solutions that address the primary interest or goals of both spouses? How do we come up with a solution that works for everybody?
So can I ask you how, I think our listeners, we've done a lot on, or I guess we've touched on litigation. Everyone knows what court is. Everyone knows what the judge is. And a lot of people don't want to do that. And I don't blame them. That's not the practice that I like to do if I can avoid it. We've touched on what mediation is. Can you tell us how collaborative law is different from mediation and litigation?
Right. So first of all, collaborative is just a real 180 from litigation. In litigation, you are governed, your basic structure of a litigated case is using your rules of civil procedure that provide for how you send discovery, how you gather information, what the timelines are, how you set something for trial, what those timelines are. In collaborative, you're essentially opting out of the rules of civil procedure and saying, okay, these are the ground rules we're going to use to govern how our case moves forward. And so instead of setting things for a hearing to provide deadlines, you self-impose deadlines. Everybody agrees to perform certain tasks by a certain date, and then follows through with that. So that is the primary difference. You're not asking someone to decide your case. You're helping the clients figure out how to solve their case, if that makes sense. In terms of mediation, it is similar to mediation, although I don't know what it's like in y'all's jurisdictions, but in Texas, mediation is something people do right before they go to trial. It's required by the courts. You basically go all day long, sometimes until midnight, and everybody tries to figure out how to either meet in the middle or, you know, using whatever facts you have, try to persuade the other side to do it the way you want. Collaborative breaks up the case into joint meetings that are 2 hours long. So it's kind of like a mediation, but in 2 hour blocks of time where people have homework in between the meetings.
Interesting. Well, I will say that legally here, our mediation is quite different. It's more of a meeting with a mediator who's a neutral third party. And usually attorneys come and we try to work out our differences with the guidance of the mediator. So I guess it's similar to yours in that, but we usually do it right away. We try to get into it as right away to keep things amicable. But remind me, I mean, legally, when I'm seeing collaborative cases going, you usually use a bunch of different professionals. Is that accurate?
Yes, there are a couple of other professionals that are often part of a collaborative case. One is a mental health professional who is neutral, who is primarily helping with communication and parenting plan work and things like that. And the other person is a neutral financial professional who takes the lead in gathering all the financial information and may help, you know, to educate one of the spouses, maybe that wasn't heavily involved in managing the household finances, and may help with post-divorce budgets and helping everyone understand what their cash flow needs are going to be post-divorce. Both experts are neutral. They're being used for their expertise, not to advocate for a particular client.
And are those required in every collaborative divorce, or can you decide, I don't think we need that person?
Yeah, they're not required. They're really encouraged, but both parties would have to agree that these professionals would add value to their case. And really, they do add a lot of value. How I describe it to clients is, you know, imagine a racing car going around the track and coming into a pit stop. And you see all these people rush out to the car. Someone's changing the tires. Someone's cleaning the windshield. Someone's putting gas in the car. And in like 10 seconds, the car's back out on the road. you know, you could have that car come into a pit stop and have one guy running around cleaning the windows, changing the tires, doing all of that. And then in a couple hours, that car might be out on the road. Having these other professionals in a collaborative case is just really an efficient use of the client's money, because the mental health person and the financial person are not only experts in their areas, their hourly rates are usually significantly less than the lawyers. So if, you know, the financial professional takes the lead to pull together all the financial information, they're doing that way more efficiently than both lawyers trying to put together the financial information.
So you're saying essentially, because I haven't kind of thought about it this way, you're saying that a collaborative could effectively, even though you're using more professionals, it could effectively save you money, maybe.
Right. I do believe in most instances it's a net savings of money. You know, if you think about it, for clients who are going to spend a lot of money getting divorced, no matter how they proceed, you know, I think one thing collaborative offers is, look, we're going to attempt to be as efficient as possible with your dollars, because every dollar they spend on the divorce is one less dollar for them or their children or whatever, you know. So, yeah, I think in the long run, it's more efficient to include the other professionals.
On average, would you say that the collaborative process takes not as long as a more typical divorce? Can you give us like a time frame, like in your experience, this is typically something that's sorted out over 6 months, or what does it usually look like?
Yeah, I think the average collaborative case is probably right at 6 months. Some go faster, some go slower. A lot depends on how motivated the parties are. You know, sometimes we have people come in and say, we want this finished 3 months from now when school is out, the end. And we'll say, okay, everyone's going to have to really commit to doing their work. You know, we have to have frequent meetings. And that includes them. You know, they're right in there having to do all the work. But I think on average, around 6 months is probably accurate.
Especially since you're not relying on court dates, right, Morgan? Like, you're not sitting around saying, right, well, we can't get in front of the judge until this day. We can't have a hearing. We can't, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's one of the things that I want to talk about is I do want to hit some of the things that I see that could be potentially problematic. And Chris, I want your opinion on it, because I think our listeners, we always want to give our listeners as much information either way for them to decide. But there's a few things I see problematic with that you could run into in collaborative. One is you could have one spouse that's not as open to setting dates or as motivated. So that could be a problem. Whereas, you know, the court would be setting those dates. The second thing I think could be a problem is if you get to come to a point where you're at a total standstill. I mean, I want to know, Chris, how do you get out of that? Because usually in mediation, we've got a facilitator who's pushing both the attorneys and the parties. And then the third issue, and what I want to hear about, is related to the fact, at least where we are in Illinois, if you sign a collaborative agreement and start with attorneys and it fails, and you have to go to court ultimately to get this thing done, you have to start over with brand new attorneys. And so that could be another downside. Lots of positives you talked about, but I also want to get out the potential downside. So what do you have to say about that, Chris?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, because, you know, one of the values of collaborative is allowing clients to make really fully informed choices. And that is part of assessing the collaborative process and whether it's right for them, is knowing that there are risks. I think you mentioned some of the more obvious ones. You know, if you have someone that's not doing the work, dragging their feet, maybe they even purposefully see advantage to them in delaying. And so that is something that I talk to clients about before we ever get into the collaborative process. What is their spouse like? You know, are they self-motivated? Are they self-disciplined? And you have to remember too, there's another lawyer the other person has a collaborative lawyer. So they're going to be explaining the same thing to their client, that if you aren't willing to do the work, this may not be the process for you. And if your spouse, if you already know they're the type to say, oh yeah, yeah, I'll get to that, I'll get to that, I'll get to that, but they procrastinate all the time, these may not be good candidates for the collaborative process. And then impasse, it does come up. You know, I will say, surprisingly, it doesn't come up as often as you might think. There's almost always a way to find a solution. But in the collaborative process, we're permitted to go to a mediation if we're just really, really stuck. And usually we'll try to hire a mediator that also does collaborative work, so they at least know kind of where we've been and what's important to these people, and can kind of approach the mediation with that sort of collaborative mindset. But that is the permitted way to try to get past an impasse. And then the last item you brought up, which is maybe the item that gets the most conversation or most discussion, is this idea that if collaborative fails or somebody really wants to go to court, they're just not satisfied in the collaborative process, they can opt out, and it forces both parties to have to fire their collaborative lawyers and go get different lawyers and law firms. They can't even use someone in that same law firm to take over and handle the traditional divorce. And what I can say about that is, you want the lawyers to be as invested in problem solving as the clients are. And I think the idea behind this, what we call a collaborative commitment, is that we all have skin in the game. If it opts out, the case is gone. Mm-hmm. For me personally, I'm as invested in settling as the clients are and looking for solutions. It also kind of tampers down the natural impulse of most lawyers to say, hey, if you don't do this, or your client's being such a jerk, we'll just go to court, or we'll set it for a hearing.
It removes
the possibility. You know, there's no, you can't threaten court. And then if for some reason the case didn't work out, which is not very often, you know, I just always reassure clients that I will get them to a really good lawyer, the best person for the job. And they're not completely starting from scratch, because usually if a case is going to fail, we've already pulled together a lot of information. And so they're starting in the case, but they're not really starting from scratch. And I also tell people, honestly, if that is so frightening to them, and I get it, I can understand the concern behind it, then collaborative probably isn't the best route for them. Exactly. You know, collaborative is not something that I think anybody should sell to a client. We are not selling it. We're just describing another option that is available to them. And if they think it's best, great.
So I would love to hear a story, because I think that for a lot of listeners, when they hear specifics and they can kind of wrap their arms around characters in a story. And something that I was thinking about when you were talking about the team of people that are involved in this process, and then Morgan was bringing up possible hurdles that couples can run into that would kind of put the kibosh on this whole thing. I'm wondering, are there times where there is a possible hurdle and it looks like, oh shit, this could be going in the direction of this ain't gonna work, for example, but then it does end up working. For example, let's say there's a couple, and if you can tell me a story, great, where things are going along just fine. And then all of a sudden, she says, you know what, we're doing the discovery part. There's more money here than what he's putting out. And I did not anticipate this. He's always been so transparent, but there's something funny about this. My gut is telling me that, I don't know why, but something is funny.
does the financial person, like, how does that all work? If all of a sudden someone kind of throws you for a loop, and has that happened? And were you able to resolve it without saying, sorry, everybody out of the pool, you're going to court?
Yeah. So, you know, there was a case once, it's been several years now, but this party had this couple had a really large estate. And at some point, the wife said, hey, I think, weren't you on the board of some company? Didn't you get stock in that? And my client said, oh my gosh, I did. I do. I have stock. I completely forgot. I mean, it's totally inadvertent. I just don't even think about it, because in terms of their overall estate, it really wasn't that significant. And he sincerely had forgotten.
Okay.
But then for the wife, it's like, well, what do you need to feel reassured that there isn't other stuff he has forgotten? And so in that particular case, she wanted the financial person to look at all their tax returns going back like 10 years, which is not common. You know, usually they do review the last 3 years of returns, but 10 is pretty extreme. But the financial person did, and tried to match up or see, is there anything in these returns that's not showing up as existing, or that doesn't seem to have an explanation? So one example.
I want to tell our listeners, it's kind of funny, because when I see collaborative cases going on in my office, you know, you can kind of tell, all the different, and they're not my cases, because we have a big firm, lots of partners, lots of attorneys. So we have a lot of conference rooms. And when I walk by the conference rooms, I can point out by looking in what case is prepping for litigation or going to litigation or in litigation in the Zoom era, what case is probably likely mediating, and what case is in a collaborative process. And I will tell you how. The litigation people are amped up. Everyone from the clients to the attorneys to potentially if they're Zooming with the judge, everyone's tense, everyone's amped up. The mediation, at times they look very serious. They're in heavy negotiations. You can tell that there's usually a mediator running around in and out of the rooms. And then there's the collaborative rooms. And they actually makes me kind of laugh, because it looks like they are having a good time. Like, they are kumbaya-ing. There's a lot of people. Usually they're sitting around, at least at my office, it's like a rule that they have to sit around a round table, so no one feels positional or across the table from one another. But I always kind of laugh, because when the collaborative rooms leave the room, it's a very calming experience that I see with the clients and the opposing sides and all the professionals walking out of my office. And so I guess there's something to be said about that.
That's such a great observation, because I think it's true. I'm also in a big firm, so I see it all, and some days here are just crazy. And, you know, there's really a good reason for that, because studies show people make much better decisions when they're not fearful and anxious and under duress. And in collaborative, we try really hard to help everyone feel calmer, less fearful, less anxious. Nothing's going to happen to them without their consent. Whatever information they need to make an informed choice, they're going to get. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea is these people are making really significant decisions that will affect the rest of their lives. And so what is the best environment for making good decisions? You know, everybody's calm, not anxious, not fearful, and feeling like they're getting all the information they need.
We talk about exactly that on this show all the time, is that it's always about it, and it's not, you can only take responsibility for yourself, right? Your job is not to defuse them. Your job is to bring yourself down so that you are calm and clear, and that you make the most informed decision from a very like grounded place, and you're not just, you know, reacting. Another thing that we do on this show a lot that we're both really proud of is we supply our listeners with action steps because we want people to listen to the show and then feel like, okay, I have a better handle on this. I know what to do. So with that in mind, if we were to give our listeners action steps for what they should ask you when they're in the process of deciding, am I right for a collaborative divorce? Let's say that they're in the Facebook groups and I'm in, they're like, I hear this term. It sounds lovely. What am I in store for? And how do I know if this will work for me or not? What should they ask?
Right. So if they're talking to me or they're talking to another lawyer that they know is collaboratively trained and offers the collaborative process as a service, because not all lawyers do, and not all lawyers want to do this. But I think the first thing they should ask is, what percentage of my practice is collaborative divorce versus other types of divorce? And I would want them to know that, because that really separates those who do collaborative and those who do not. The second question I would want them to ask is, what do they view, like my opinion as to the benefits and risk of collaborative? And then three, I think they should ask, after they've told the lawyer the facts of their case and what's important to them, asking, how does the lawyer assess the likelihood of success for them in collaborative? You know, in that lawyer's opinion, is there anything they've heard that makes it sound more likely or less likely that they would be able to succeed in the collaborative process?
I love it. Number one, your number one is ask the lawyer how much collaborative they do. I mean, if someone asked me that, I would be honest and be like, look, I always joke I do collaborative light. I don't do the actual process, but I know the people to bring in. I know the people on the other side that I think I can work well with, but I don't do what you do. And I do offer it through other partners in the firm, but I don't do that. And I would be absolutely honest with any client asking me that. The second one you talked about is asking what the risks are and what it looks like in their case. That brings me to a question about something that if our listeners are listening and they're like, who, like, would this even work for me? And who are the people that it absolutely would not work for? One of the things that come to my mind where it would not work in my mind is somebody who has substantial trust issues with discovery or documents or finances. I think that that could be pretty tricky, because if you don't trust the other side to provide accurate information, this may not be the process for you. What else could you think of, Chris, of somebody who this process is just not going to work for them?
Yeah, there are some things. I think it can be quite challenging if there's untreated mental health issue or substance abuse issue. I think when there's physical or emotional abuse, our statute allows a collaborative process to proceed in that situation, but only if the victim of abuse says they really want to do collaborative, and then the professionals create some kind of safety plan. But still, it makes it a lot more challenging just because of that power dynamic. And I think someone who's just fundamentally dishonest, you know, doesn't file their tax returns or cheats on their tax returns, like, they're not suddenly going to become a better person in a divorce. And there are, unfortunately, people out there that are only going to do or not do things if there's a real consequence, like a judge or a fine or a sanction. You know, there are people that only kind of behave if they know that's a possible consequence.
I agree.
And collaborative doesn't have those consequences. Like, you can't, there isn't a judge that can say, hey, sir, you lied, so you need to pay X amount in attorney's fees or whatever. So I think those cases are going to be quite challenging if someone comes in and reveals facts that are any of those situations. And I actually just heard a speaker at a recent conference say, that in her opinion, she was a mental health professional, you shouldn't ever have a collaborative case with a narcissist. I will say that that seemed a little too general to me since—
Right, isn't everyone a narcissist these days?
Well, and especially some of our most successful business types or political types, we're in the state capital here, have some of those tendencies, but, and their spouse may call them a narcissist, but, you know, they're still capable of being reasonable in a divorce situation. But anything like that, any of those kind of extreme behaviors are going to make a collaborative divorce a lot more challenging.
Does the amount of money at stake have anything to do with this? Meaning, if somebody's got a lot riding on this, do you find that those divorcing couples don't really even look towards collaborative, or is that not the case at all? And regardless of the amount of money, they're going to do this.
Yeah, I think it's actually the opposite.
Really?
Yes. We've many people of substantial wealth who, you know, one reason they are wealthy is they don't waste any money. Mm. And they see collaborative as a more efficient use of their dollars. Secondly, it's very private. There's hardly anything filed in the court record. So, you know, they can come in, get divorced, divide all their financial stuff, and leave little trace of that in the public record. And I think they find that very appealing.
That is so interesting, because my first thought was the opposite. It was that people who have so much to lose would be more anxious and, like, you know, like bearing down and like, I'm not letting, I guess if that would, they would fall into the category of something more unhealthy, where if someone is burned on either side because there was infidelity or something like that, I could see things going wacky. That's a side question. Do you find, like, in a case where there was infidelity and someone's really emotionally burned, no one's a narcissist that we're aware of, there wasn't abuse, but somebody was cheated on, can collaborative work for them? Or are there tend to be like real hard feelings and they won't work together?
Right. How do you depose the girlfriend or boyfriend or other in a collaborative case? You can't, right?
Yeah, you don't depose them. You know, so many cases do involve infidelity. Those absolutely can succeed in collaborative for a host of reasons. But, you know, it really depends on the particular case, because, you know, if the person who was cheated on is so full of rage and a desire for punishment and retribution, then collaborative may not be the right fit for them, because there is no penalty person in a collaborative case. There's nobody that, unfortunately, or, you know, a lot of people believe a judge can do that, that a judge will go, your spouse is the most horrible person in the world and your punishment is. Our judges, maybe they're desensitized to it, but they're just not ever going to do that.
I agree. I got to tell you, legally here, I mean, if I get a client who wants punishment or wants accountability, there may be some accountability, but it's really highly unlikely that they're going to get the vindication or the, you know, the thing that they're really feeling that they're missing from a judge. They're going, most of the time when my clients, even when we win, to them, it feels like a slap on the wrist instead of you're getting thrown in jail, kind of a ending that they think that this judge or a judge would have.
You know, Morgan, this reminds me of an episode that we did over a year ago with Dr. Randy Heller, where we were talking about healing from infidelity. Yes. And also the things that everyone goes through, and that there's no real vindication. There's no real revenge. You just have to work through this. You're not going to have that moment, right? Where it's like, and now she sees, and now she'll never do that again. Nah, she probably will. I'm wondering, and I want to get to the recap in just a minute, because I know that people are probably like, tell me those action steps one more time. But when a collaborative divorce is finalized and I'm assuming there's still an MSA that's drawn up and you sign it, does the divorcing couple then still go before the judge to finalize everything, or does that not happen?
In my area, yes, they would. So usually there's one time where we either submit paperwork and they're divorced without appearing, or a judge may require them to appear. So usually if we do it right, it's one and only time in court, if that.
Wait, but what's the deciding factor, Morgan? Why would it be sometimes yes and sometimes no, that they don't have to go?
Well, at least where I am, the courts are starting to adopt what we call divorces by affidavit, and they're starting to have this movement. So a lot of cases are able to just submit paperwork. Some judges feel like cases are too complex, or there's been different issues in the matter, and they'll actually require the parties to come. And some courts, or even around me still, don't do any prove up by affidavit or divorce by affidavit, and they want everyone to appear, even if it's on Zoom for the last day.
Okay, so what's going on down in Texas right now?
Yeah, in Texas, you used to, at the conclusion of any divorce case, including collaborative, one of the parties would have to present the decree with their lawyer to the judge in person. Then COVID hit and everything started to get submitted online by affidavit. And that is something that has continued here in at least our area. The judges, if it's an agreed divorce, you can submit everything online with an affidavit. So there's no court appearance at all.
Oh, wow. They stay out of court the entire time.
Yeah, although I do want to say there are people, even if a judge isn't going to punish their spouse, there are people that just want to have their day in court.
Yeah,
you know, and that's really the point for me. All of these options exist. And as long as we, the professionals, give a person all the pros and cons of all their different options, then they get to choose. It's their life. You know, if they need the day in court, then they should have their day in court.
I think that this is so interesting. Let's recap those questions that you feel that someone should ask if they're interested in a collaborative. Let's just run through them one more time so that people don't feel the need to pull their car over and take notes, just so it's in your brain. And friends, I will make sure that all of this is in the show notes. But one more time, give us those questions.
Question number one is, what percentage of your divorces fall into the category of collaborative divorce, where everybody actually signs the document that says you're not going to court?
Okay.
The second question is, what do you view the benefits and risk generally of proceeding per the collaborative process versus any other option? And the third question is, after hearing the facts of my case, how do you assess the likelihood of success for me in my case in the collaborative process? Because a lawyer can sit down and definitely give them a sense of whether it's likely they will make it or, there's a lot of red flags here.
Okay. Chris, I love this episode, and I like it because I actually feel like I learned a little bit of things as well. So thank you for that. And thank you for deciphering for our listeners what the differences of the different processes are, because this is a big decision. And I know that our listeners, when they're starting to look into divorce, are hearing all these buzzwords and their head's spinning already. And now this just kind of breaks it down, and we appreciate that. And we thank you for coming onto our show tonight. And what we're going to do is we're going to link your web address so that if people want to contact you, or you're looking for an attorney in the Austin, Texas area, they can get in touch with you.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. I love having an opportunity to talk about collaborative. So anytime, I'm happy to come back and do follow-up questions.
Yay.
Thank you.
And we will have to schedule another time, especially for our private group on Patreon. We will make sure that we get you scheduled again so you can answer some questions that we get for our private listeners. So guys, stay tuned for that. We will make sure that all links to reach out to you are in the show notes. So should anyone be in the Austin area and looking for a collaborative divorce, or maybe have more questions on if that's right for them, you are in luck because we have got your gal. So thank you so much for being here. This was a really cool conversation. You know what I kept thinking about that was so dumb, but of course something that I would think about is like, what if some like silly Instagram influencer wants to have a collaborative divorce just because they're so desperate for a collab?
Oh my, what? I don't know. Have you had enough wine or not enough wine tonight? Because that was awful.
Every time I hear the word collab, like I think like, do you want to do a collab? You want to collab? Right. I mean, it's just, and now of course, see, I warned you that there would be children.
It's cool. Let's just keep going because I see him, but I'm going to act like I don't. But here's the thing. It's funny because for those non-Instagrammers like myself, when you think about, when I think about collab, that's so not what comes to my mind at all.
Funny. It ruins your world, friends. Friends don't let friends become influencers. So speaking of influencers, as we segue into fan mail.
Okay, let's see which Nigerian prince DM'd us today.
If you're really a prince, I'll marry you.
This is fan mail.
So, you know, I'm a little bit of an influencer. And this weekend, I was actually out at a party, which I rarely go to, but I was out at like a family Cinco de Mayo party in my area. And there were a lot of people there who don't know me in real life, but they know me from what I do online and they listen to the show or whatever. And it was so interesting because much like Proud Mary, who approached you in the courtroom, I had several people approach me and say, I just want to let you know that I mention what you do to so-and-so, 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 so-and-so. And, you know, unfortunately, I'm entering that phase of life where a lot of the people our age are starting to get divorced, right? Mm-hmm. It's a thing. You kind of go through that little epidemic. But it was so nice because when these people were saying it to me, they were like, and we know that they're in good hands with you. So they're going to reach out to you. I know you'll take care of them. Aww. I know that you and Morgan can help them. And I just thought, what a weird world, but how nice that we've gained that the trust of people, because that's what it's all about, right?
Like it is. You know, and not to toot our own horn, but we really truly do care about our listeners. And, you know, I spend a lot of time during the week just making sure that I answer anyone who is looking for an attorney, even if it's out of state, out of my state, et cetera, and getting them some referrals. So whenever you guys need something like that, just let us know. That's why we're here. We just want to make sure that everyone's doing this process just as best as you can.
And it's not an easy process. We talk about that every episode, right? It was easy. If it were easy, we wouldn't even have a show because there would be no sucking or not sucking. It would just be. But we do because it's hard. And I'm so grateful that you guys trust us and that you're here with us every week and that you participate in our private communities and you message us and you allow us to help you. You allow us to be a really tiny part of your lives because it just, it brightens our days. It really does. Just knowing that something that we do matters because, hey, we have hard days too. There are days that it's hard. I mean, it's hard for you, Morgan. You're going through work stuff right now. The days can be long.
Oh yeah. It's like the never ending day. And that's what we always talk about. Divorce is a marathon. It is not a sprint. Some days are going to be great. Others are going to be horrendous. Some are just going to be like, I made it through the day and that's enough. And whatever day you're in, don't worry. There's hopefully always another day. And that's what matters.
That's exactly right. On your good days, on your bad days, and on your really, really bad days, we are here for you. We're here to guide you, give you the information, entertainment, and empathy that you deserve as you navigate your way through this divorce process. So friends, if you haven't yet rated and reviewed our show, Please do that. We love it so much. And it's not because it makes us feel popular. I mean, maybe a little bit, but it's really because it helps us bring the caliber of guests that you guys deserve. So every single rating and review matters. Join our private communities. There are links to all of those in the show notes. And you've got this. We are here for you every single step of the way.
No big deal. If you heard a child in the background, that's just our life because we're having one of those days. But anyway, we're signing off. Don't forget this. You've got this, and we've got you. Until next week, take care.
For more support, please join our private communities on Facebook and Patreon. The How Not to Suck at Divorce podcast is executively produced by Andrea Rappaport.